Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Quote, "We cannot undo the past, correct it or ignore it," my guest today, historian Bernard Powers, has observed, "but we can use it wisely in the landscape by looking for the best in people, respecting differences and learning important lessons, especially tolerance, to help us move forward as one people." Dr. Powers' words are as important now in early November 2022 as when he uttered them 2 years ago. Dr. Powers graduated Gustavus with a major in history in 1972. He went on to earn an MA and PhD in American history from Northwestern University. Now retired, and I put that word in air quotes, he enjoyed a distinguished career as professor of history at the College of Charleston, where he directs the Center for the Study of Slavery in Charleston and is a professor emeritus. He remains active as a scholar and public historian, and no one knows more about the history of slavery and black people in Charleston than does he. His major publications include the indispensable book Black Charlestonians, A Social History, 1822 to 1885, which was named a Choice Magazine Outstanding Academic Book for 1995, a manual, The Untold Story of the Victims and Survivors of the Charleston Church Shooting, and the edited volume 101, 101 African Americans Who Shaped South Carolina, published by the University of South Carolina Press in 2020. He's also authored numerous conference papers and scholarly and popular articles, as well as many book reviews. In addition to his scholarship in directing the Center for the Study of Slavery, Dr. Powers is also interim president of the International African American Museum, or IAAM, opening soon in Charleston in January 2023. My department colleagues and I had the pleasure of meeting and hosting Dr. Powers in early October 2022 when he was on campus to receive his alma mater's Distinguished Alumni Golden Anniversary Award. He and I already had been in touch about recording an episode for the podcast, and meeting and hearing him in person only made me all the more eager to do so, which is why I'm especially grateful he could join me to talk about his time at Gustavus, his career as a historian, and the history of slavery and black life in Charleston. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Powers. Bernie, it's really a real treat to have you on.
Well, Greg, thank you very much. I'm glad that that we've been able to finally get together.
Yeah, we did. I knew we would. Yeah. There was no way I was not going to record with you.
well, my goodness. It's my pleasure and my opportunity. So I appreciate your persistence.
Well, it's my pleasure too, believe me. We were talking just briefly before we started recording. I mean, it's amazing the number of historians who've come out of Gustavus, not just Jim McPherson. Everybody seems to know Jim, you know, the Civil War historian, but you and Bill Green, with whom I podcasted, and sure, lots of younger people you wouldn't know. I'm thinking of Sarah Fatherly, who's now an administrator, but Tim Thurber at Virginia Commonwealth. I mean, just on and on and on. It's really something. You're one of them, and thanks so much for joining me. So I know, am I right that you grew up in Chicago?
Yes.
Let's start with, we're both historians. Let's start with you and your history. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you came to Gustavus.
Yeah. So I have a somewhat unusual background in the sense that both of my parents were born in Chicago. Now, their parents, my grandparents, migrated from other places. But my parents were born in Chicago, and I was also on the far south side, and went to public schools in Chicago, and eventually attended Northwestern University, did the PhD in history there, but you know the story about me coming to Gustavus is also an unusual one too, because I found out about Gustavus through a guidance counselor at my high school.
Okay, that seems to be the story so often.
Dorothy Ritchie. Ritchie was her name, and I'm deeply indebted to her today. Because although I was a pretty good student, my my intention was to go to college at a junior college for 2 years, take an associate of arts degree in something or other, and go on and get a job. And when I told her that, she says, no, 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 I want you to be in my office on such and such a date at such and such a time and talk to some people who are going to be coming here recruiting students. And it was someone from Gustavus. It may very well have been Bruce Gray.
Bruce Gray, I wonder. Yeah.
It was either Bruce Gray or Owen Samuelson or both of them. And so I spoke with them, and I was kind of interested in finding out more about Gustavus. And so I also found out something else. Now, I grew up as a member of and remain a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME Church.
Sure.
Well, I found out that one of our associate ministers, his daughter was a student at Gustavus. She was a junior at Gustavus. You know, so we're talking about an African-American woman. So I talked with her a bit about the school. And so I ended up going up to Gustavus. This is the first time I had ever been on an airplane.
Oh, wow.
First time. And so go up and spent the weekend there. Bunked with a guy from Chicago, south side of Chicago. So that was good. And so to make a long story short, I really enjoyed my experience there over the weekend. I liked the people that I met. And so that's how I ended up choosing Gustavus. I didn't apply to a whole bunch of schools. I applied to several schools. But Gustavus was the winner. And I'll just say this also, that I had friends that applied for and were admitted to Carleton down the road. And so I went down there and visited also. But, you know, I said, well, you know, I really want to be a serious student, and maybe I should go to a different school so that I don't get caught up in the, you know, partying and all that kind of thing. So that kind of was a deterrent to following my friends, you know, down the road to Northfield. And so pushed me in the direction of Gustavus also. And, you know, I said, well, you know, Gustavus will be close enough. And so if I want to see these guys, I can just
right.
Hop on down there, you know, and likewise. So,
it's
yeah.
Funny.
That's
so funny. You know, yeah. I love these stories because, first of all, what if that guidance counselor hadn't
yes.
intervened,
yeah.
right? You just never know.
That's right.
When you, and by the way, that was also a factor for me. I went to Northern Illinois University. It turned out I had a good history department, thank God, really good.
Yes.
I didn't know it. Yeah, I just knew I didn't want to go to U of I, where some of my, mm-hmm. some of the people I knew were going, kind of for the same reason. I was afraid I'd get distracted or you'd spend more time socializing than studying.
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
Right.
But, when you came, I want to hear more about, I want to back up in a minute, but first, when you came to Gustavus for that visit, were you introduced to other Black students, or what was it like to kind of such a white campus then?
Yes, I was. And of course, the young lady who attended my church was there. And
okay,
so that,
right.
And
sure.
so that made the entree very easy. Because, you know, she had several friends there, and that's really how I ended up bunking with a guy from Chicago, because when I talked with her, you know, she says, oh, well, you know, there's another guy from Chicago up here, you know, his name is John, and
also Black student, you mean?
Yes, a Black student.
Yeah.
And so you know, we were able to make that specific arrangement for, you know, for me to stay with him, and we got on very well. There weren't a lot of Black students, obviously.
Right.
But and there were, I'm sure there were more women than men. And the young lady that I knew, who was, let's see, she would have been a junior. She was a very serious student, a very serious person. So she introduced me to other really serious students, which doesn't mean that they weren't fun people.
Sure, right.
But they really were the kind of folk who were very nice, but they were also serious, and I knew that in that environment, I'd get on well with them, and that they'd help me to find my way, and you know, and all of that. So have a nice time over that weekend.
That's good. The weekend visits are the visits seem to work. They're magic.
Yeah.
So when you were growing up in Chicago, and I think I told you before we started recording, my dad was born in Chicago, Greek immigrant. He was born in the U.S., but his parents came from Greece. But I grew up in the South suburbs, mostly Park Forest, but I love Chicago still. We were so oriented toward Chicago. My mother grew up on a farm south of Champaign-Urbana. Anyway, when you were growing up, were your parents? I mean, were they emphasizing learning? I'm kind of thinking my dad did not go to college, but he sure as hell emphasized the importance of knowledge, and I'm grateful for that to this day.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, my father would say things like, "Well, you know, you should have a better life than you know than I do," and his life has been a great life. Both of my parents graduated from high school, and they also graduated from Moody Bible Institute.
Oh yeah, wow.
Yeah. So very very religious people, but neither one of them have a standard college degree, but they really encouraged me to go to college and to work hard. And in fact, it's funny, and what I'm going to tell you really dates me. Before I actually enrolled in the school, and it would have been the fall of 1968,
right?
Just before, you know, the send off and all that, my dad had a talk with me, and he says, now look, I want you to get up there and be real serious and don't mess up the family's money. And if you don't do well, you can come home and go right down the street to that gas station and pump gas down there.
Wow.
And so, I mean, when is the last time you've seen a gas station attendant pumping gas?
Exactly.
A long time ago.
Yes, there was a time when they came out and checked the oil and cleaned the windshield and pumped the gas. Yeah.
That's right.
But yeah, that's amazing. I mean, he was kind of throwing down the gauntlet, I guess.
Oh yeah. But both were very encouraging, believed in the power of education.
Yes.
My mother did a variety of jobs, and at the end of her work life, she was a librarian assistant at one of the Chicago public schools, and had worked in a number of schools. And you know, my mother, as a kid, my mother, just to illustrate this this point, my mother would take me to the library. They had a Saturday story reading time, and my mother took me up to the library. I went to the story reading on that Saturday, and then my mother helped me pick out books because she intended on me to read those books. And guess what? Over the summertime, you know, she said, "Look, you're not going to be running the streets and spending all your time up there at the baseball field." So she had me pick out books to be read, but not only to be read, I'd have to write her book reports of each one of the books, and they had to be written with good penmanship.
That's amazing.
Also, otherwise I'd have to write them over.
That's amazing.
That's also
we both know, I mean, as we get older, that's a gift. It's an incredible gift.
Yes.
Yeah. My, yes, um, yes, yes. That's a gift, yeah. My father too, he emphasized writing, I remember, and reading. Yeah. He read the newspaper mostly is what he mm-hmm. read, the newspaper. But
mm-hmm. yes.
That idea of education and knowledge.
Yes.
And my, you know, there's that cliche, knowledge is power. I can hear my father saying that so many times. My mom went to a two-year teacher college and then mm-hmm. Stopped teaching eventually, and they were both hairdressers. My Greek grandfather had a barbershop in Oak Park at the Marion Street L for a long time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, did you have brothers and sisters?
I have one younger brother. He is 10 years younger than me.
Is he an academic also?
No. He worked in the banking industry. And then eventually started his own marketing company. Yeah.
Neat. Yeah. Now, your parents, I think you said, were born in Chicago. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Were their parents part of the Great Migration, or were they immigrate?
Yeah. Yes. They were. My grandfather's, and I know their story best, both of them migrated up from Alabama.
Okay.
Yeah. And Greg, my maternal grandfather was in Chicago in time for the riot of 1919.
The horrible riots.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. In fact, he almost became a victim of that racial clash. And I always used his example in the lecture that I did on the riot in Chicago in 1919, because he had a dentist appointment in downtown. He lived on the South Side. He had a dentist appointment, and he was riding on the streetcar and going down to his dentist appointment. And my grandfather was a sharp dresser. So I think he said he had on a white suit and a Panama hat and going downtown and riding on the streetcar. And he says white people were looking at him. Mm. And he figures they're looking at how nattily he was dressed.
Sure.
You know. And so he goes down, has a white dentist, and the dentist says, "Well, John, what are you doing out and about?" And my grandfather says, "Well, what?" He says, "Well, there's a riot going on." And so my grandfather, I don't know whether he received the treatment that he had gone for or not, but anyway, he returned home on the streetcar. And he got down into the area of where Comiskey Park is located today, you know, down in the 30s, in the 30s, headed south. And there was a mob of white men that were running over toward the streetcar with the intention of stopping it and obviously harming any black person who was on board. Except the driver, the streetcar driver, opened up the throttle fully and sped up. He wouldn't stop.
Wow.
And that may very well have preserved my grandfather's life.
That's an incredible story.
Yeah. So he was right there, and he's the one who told me that story.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, people, I mean, I don't know, a lot of people don't even know about the Tulsa riot, but yeah, the Chicago, the 1919 riot in Chicago is just deadly. And
yes.
You know, I mean, some of it is a little boy floating across the imaginary line in Lake Michigan from the black section to the white section, and then all hell. I mean, it's god awful.
It's amazing.
It's
amazing.
And I don't know about Chicago. I mean, it's, you know, I was a big fan of Harold Washington. I didn't live there. I couldn't vote for him, but I was so happy. And so,
yeah, sure.
My dad, I remember my dad got to meet him at one point. But anyway, you know, I lived in Chicago, the suburbs, and then Boston, some pretty segregated places. But that history, the racial history, and the history of the Great Migration is really incredible. I'm glad your grandfather was okay. When you said streetcar, I thought, oh, my God, that doesn't sound good.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I think I've seen photos even of streetcars being
mobbed. Yeah. And of course, I remember, I remember streetcars with the tracks.
Right.
And just for the listening audience who may not know, I mean, a streetcar was not maneuverable. I mean, it wasn't like a wheeled vehicle. It had to run in a track.
Right.
It had to run in a track.
Yeah.
And the electricity was supplied by these, I don't know what you call them, but the lines, the electrical lines that ran up above.
Yeah, overhead, right?
Yeah, overhead. So you couldn't just like steer this thing out of the way. You were locked into a track.
It's amazing that was the driver white, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
it's amazing.
Yes,
amazing
white driver, yeah.
What he did, actually.
What he was thinking. But I'm eternally grateful that he didn't stop.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm just thinking here, there's a whole racial history of streetcars in a lot of different cities.
Oh, yes.
Oh my God.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
It's incredible.
I mean right here in Charleston, after the war, and of course, in Charleston, we just say the war and everybody knows where
we're fighting. Yeah, they know what war. It's not World War II.
No, not the good war.
It's that war.
Yeah, not the good war. That war, yeah. There was a new horse-drawn streetcar that was instituted in 1866, and at this time the city was still under the authority of the Union Army, and the Freedmen's Bureau was present here, and so on. And so the streetcars confined black riders to the running board. They couldn't sit on the inside of the streetcars, except given their newly won freedom, these former enslaved people decided, no, that's not what freedom meant. Freedom meant that they ought to be able to exercise full citizenship and sit wherever they wanted to sit, you know, according to the ticket that they bought.
Right.
And so the local white newspaper said that these black people invaded the interior.
There's that word. Yeah. It's always an invasion.
Yeah, that's right. Invaded the interior and sat promiscuously.
Oh, wow. That word too.
Amongst the white ridership. And eventually the Freedmen's Bureau stepped in and, you know, made a declaration that if the streetcar was going to continue operating, it would have to be available to the interior. The inside would have to be available to all.
Isn't that amazing? Whatever we want to call them, micro history, these little bits and pieces of what emancipation meant, what freedom meant.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Exactly. You know, if I'm free, I'm not riding on the running board or standing.
In the rain. Beating, burning sun.
That's amazing. When you were like in high school, were you already really interested in history? Did you know? Was that from teachers or parents or what?
Yeah, teachers. I was interviewed in the Harlan Falcon newspaper. I went to Harlan High School, and the newspaper was called the Harlan Falcon. And so I was interviewed. They interviewed a number of seniors. And so in that interview, I reported that I was either going to major in chemistry or history.
Oh, okay.
Because I like both courses of study. You know, in high school, I liked the teachers very much. As it turns out, Greg, I began at Gustavus as a chemistry major.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right. As a chemistry major. The summer that I graduated from high school, that summer I worked at a chemical company, mainly in the factory, but spent some time in the lab also. And every summer I was in college, I worked in that same chemical company, and they told me that if I finished a degree in chemistry, I would certainly receive a job.
You'd have a job.
Offered a job.
Yeah.
But after really the first year. The first year at Gustavus, I said, no, this really is not for me. And the irony is, I felt very lonely as a chemistry major. Hmm. And what I mean by that is, I'd be in the laboratory. Sometimes you'd be there on Saturday. You'd be by yourself. You'd be doing an experiment. You'd be waiting for the color of the solution to change or the precipitate to drop out of something. And you're there, and it was solitary work. And I felt kind of alone and alienated, quite frankly. And so I switched to my other love, which is history. And I was helped to make that decision by Bill Green.
Oh, classmate Bill Green, yeah.
Yeah. Because he started off as a history major, and he was telling me about the great professors and what he was learning and everything, showing me the books, and just, hey, you know, you ought to take some more history courses. And so I did. And really loved it, and so I switched majors and became a history major.
That's great.
Yeah.
Switched. I love that story. I love it just because so many students, you know, you've taught. I mean, so many students think they have to have it all figured out in advance, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Go with your love. Go with what you're really enjoying.
Yeah. Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit more about your experiences at Gustavus, partly because I teach a whole course on 1968. That's the year you arrived. So I'm curious to hear you think back on about the kind of place it was. I think I read a quote from you, something like learning was everywhere. You know, the ways in which Gustavus was intersecting with the wider world, and that's such an extraordinary year, but also what it was like for you as a, touched on this a little bit earlier, but you know, what it was like for you across the 4 years as a Black student. Were you hanging out with mostly other Black students? Were you part of, I don't know what it would have been called there, the Black Student Organization, if that's what it was, but both of those questions, just what was it like to be at Gustavus in 1968? Through the early 70s, really. You're there at the end of the long 1960s, so-called. But especially, you know, also what it's like to be a young Black man at a place like Gustavus in that period.
Yeah. So it was a different environment, obviously, because it was so overwhelmingly white, not just the campus, but St. Peter.
The state.
Right. So it was very different.
Very different now, than Chicago. My God.
Goodness. Yeah. But it wasn't a complete, and the school was not a complete and total culture shock, because I went to a predominantly white elementary school. A high school that was predominantly Black, but at least when I started there in 1964, there was, and this was a new high school, Harlan High School. There was a significant number of white students there also. So I had never been in a totally segregated school environment, but nevertheless, I really had not been, so to speak, the leavening in the bread either. because I mean, I think, Greg, that in 1968 there were probably maybe 20 some Black students. I mean, that's
right. I think that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah. That were there on the campus. And so, you know, one of the things that it meant was that lots of people knew you or knew of you, knew your name. But, you know, you didn't really know all of the people who knew you or knew of you, or knew of you by by reputation. And of course, it meant that very frequently you were the only black person in a class.
Sure.
There were no black professors until, in fact, there were no black professors, tenured or tenure track professors the whole time that I was there. Now, toward the latter part of my experience there, we had Reuben Sheeler, who was brought in during the January.
Right. Training. That is so fascinating. Go ahead. I only recently learned about this.
Yeah. And this was a faculty exchange with Donover Lund, Dr. Donover Lund from Gustavus. And Dr. Lund went down to Texas Southern, and Reuben Sheeler came up to GAC for that January term. And I'm not sure what Dr. Lund taught down there, but Reuben Sheeler did a kind of a mini course in African American history.
Yeah.
So that was so important in terms of introducing me to the subject, at least introducing me to the subject as presented by a professional historian.
Right. Know?
And so that was good. And then later we had someone else who's I'm just blocking on his name, but who came from he was a graduate student, an advanced graduate student, who came from the U, and came
from
up
University came of Minnesota. Okay,
University of Minnesota, yeah. And did a January term also. He subsequently published a book on they called him Bruce Grit, and I'm blocking on the fellow's the historical figure's real name.
Really?
Yeah. But anyway,
was he a Minnesotan figure or?
No.
He
was not a Minnesota figure, and I can't recall where he was from, but he was considered a 19th century, early 20th century black nationalist.
Okay.
So,
yeah. And was this graduate student himself black or what?
Yes. Yeah. An African American fellow.
Okay.
And I'm unfortunately just blocking on his.
No, that's okay. Name, but I mean, it just I'm trying to imagine what it would be. I mean, were you so? You know, Dr. Sheer, was it Sheeler or Sheer? I'm trying to remember.
Sheeler.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I literally only recently found out about this. Doing some digging in the. Online student newspaper, and I was stunned. Mm-hmm. I mean, oh my God, we've not had an African American historian since. And I read, maybe you can shed some light on this, that he was involved. It seemed like he was encouraging black students to form it may have been called Afro American Culture Club or something like that. It just seemed like there you were bringing, I don't know if you were involved in it, but God, the number of people, black figures, prominent figures, including, for example, Fannie Hamer, I think, and others coming through, may have been after you graduated, but just an amazing, seemed like amazing energy and activism among black students, few in number, but around, you know, how do we move forward from this J term to sort of making visible African American, we've said then, or black culture and history on campus.
I remember there was an African American fellow who was running for, I believe it was the U.S. Senate. I can't remember his name either. From Minnesota, and he came to the campus and did a talk, and. A fellow that I've had a fair amount of contact with, where we live here now in South Carolina, Cleve Sellers.
Oh my gosh!
Cleve Sellers
from SNCC and
Student
Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Cleve.
Yeah, I saw that he was on campus.
Cleve Sellers came up and did a talk and Cleve subsequently. Married a young lady who he met up at Gustavus.
Oh my gosh!
Yes,
wow.
A young lady from Memphis, and I believe that their son, certainly Cleve's son, but I think it's the young man is her son also, Bakari Sellers, who's a regular comment. He's an attorney and a regular political analyst on CNN today.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah. So
that's funny. For listeners, Cleveland Sellers, I mean, he's all over the history books, right? And the civil rights movement,
yeah,
in this house.
Oh,
student,
yeah,
nonviolent coordinating committee. Yeah, I did see that he, yeah, was there. So you were there, you knew him, that's cool.
Yeah.
Was there, so I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what it would, I mean, I know how I felt coming to Minnesota, even, yeah, I thought I was a Midwesterner, and coming from Boston and Chicago, mm-hmm, Chicago, mm-hmm, then Boston, where I did my grad, to St. Peter. But I wonder, did you experience overt racism, or was it all what we would call today microaggressions, or, I mean, did being there change your understanding of yourself as a Black person, a Black man?
Yeah. Well, it made you much more conscious of race and racial issues. Because I mean, growing up, I was a member of a Black church in a Black denomination, and although when I started high school, as I said, there were some. There was a significant number of white students present at high school that I attended. It was a new high school, but over time the number dwindled. So it became a predominantly Black high school by the time that I graduated. Lived on the south side of Chicago, overwhelmingly Black. I mean, when Bill Green came up and stayed with me one weekend, we got up on Saturday morning and I said, come on, man, we're just going to drive around the city. And we're driving around on the south side, going various places and so on. And now he's from New Orleans, but he finally says, hey man, aren't there any white people on the south side of Chicago? And I said, well, yeah, but none that live right around in this area. You know, you have to kind of go a distance. They live over on the southwestern part of the city, you know, right, what have you, you know. Yeah. it was a very different situation. And so you did become much more conscious of race issues in the midst of the sea of whiteness that you were surrounded by on the campus.
Yes.
Now, in class, you were virtually always the only Black student. And sometimes racial issues would be discussed. I mean, after all, this is the late 60s, early 70s, and so on. And so one of the things that could be very uncomfortable was that when these matters came up, you know, everyone expected you to be the voice of Blackness.
Right. You were the spokesperson, right?
Yeah, you're the spokesperson for the race.
Right. Yeah,
you know, exactly. Every point of view and all of that, you know. So that could be very uncomfortable. And people sometimes approached you in, through the stereotypical images that they had,
yes,
of Black people.
Yes, yes.
You know, and so, I mean, I grew up living in a single family home, a new home, really. And, you know, my father was a skilled craftsman and built most of the house himself, you know.
Wow.
And my parents were educated people. I lived in a biparental family. And that kind of arrangement. But I could remember people assuming that I lived in public housing in a ghetto.
Right.
Knew that experience. After
no,
all,
no dad. And,
yeah, blah, no blah, dad. Yeah. The dad right. has gone and run yeah. off. And,
yeah, right. that's a really important point. I mean, how the expectations that, and this is still true, right? That you can bring to meeting someone. Yeah.
Listen. I heard John Hope Franklin, really the dean of African American historians, while he was alive, tell this story multiple times about being mistaken as a janitor or building superintendent, some person who ought to be providing service to white people while he was attending professional conferences.
Yeah.
So, and I've had that experience also as a professor.
Yeah, of course. So, I've never had that experience. I can only imagine. I've witnessed it with our friend from Carleton. It's awful.
And so of course this happened on the campus, too. So
at the same time, go ahead.
And then the other thing, part of that burden was, you always felt that you had to be on your best behavior.
Right.
Because the destiny of the race was riding on your shoulders.
That's right. You literally anticipated what I was going to ask next.
So that was a burden of race that no white student carried. That's right. But that's how you were raised. You were raised to carry that burden, and you just assumed it because you recognized that everything that you were doing during that time period, after all, 1968, Dr. King had just been assassinated.
Right.
You were representing the race.
That's right.
You were the avant-garde of the race as a college student. Creating, you had the potential to create a new record of achievement and success. And so you had to present yourself in a way that would accrue benefit for the race in the struggle.
Right.
So
was there a sense of, you mentioned King's assassination, that's in April of 68, but was there a sense when you, in your time at Gustavus, was Black nationalism much of a presence on campus? And if so, were you at all drawn to that?
It became an increasingly pervasive feeling amongst a minority of Black students.
Okay.
And so, for example, now, you asked me about my interaction with other students. So, I really interacted with all kinds of students on campus. Sometimes Dave and I sat in the cafeteria with white students.
Dave being Bill Green.
Dave being Bill
That's
Green.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You knew it was Dave.
Bill Green. Yeah, because I mainly.
But I'm sorry, you were in the cafeteria.
Yeah. We're in the cafeteria. We one evening or one morning we'd have breakfast with white students. Maybe the next day we'd have our dinner at the quote unquote Black table, Sometimes some Black students will ridicule you and say, "Hey, why are you eating with those white kids?" Well, they were our friends. We got on with them. We had something in common. We had classes together. We studied together. So what? That sometimes came up as an issue, but it was not generally an issue.
Okay.
Not generally an issue.
Yeah.
Sometimes the white students noticed it also, and they would say, "Hey, why is it that unlike most of the black students who eat together all of the time, you know, you and Dave kind of float around. And I said, well, hey, you know, people are people.
Right. You're two historians making. You're interested in human beings.
Yeah.
You're
that's
curious.
Right. That's yeah, right. That's
exactly.
Right. Exactly right.
The,
exactly.
You know, and the other, I mean, I want to, now you can say more about this, obviously. I guess this could be a whole another podcast and probably will be, but the role of Bruce and Sue Gray and Owen Samuelson and, mm-hmm. And others. I mean, these are all white folks, really, well, except for Fred Brown, who was a professor. I don't think he was mm-hmm. a Gustavus alum, but people who were, as I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, trying to reach out, more than reach out, really, to try to help black students at Gustavus. What's the word? Adjust. I mean, we all had, yeah. I mean, I had to go yeah, through an yeah. adjustment.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
But to really, the yeah. word, I guess, would be to nurture and mentor. Yeah. Do you have some memories of those folks?
Oh, yeah. Well, Bruce Gray would call us in regularly. You know, and when I say regularly, I mean a couple of times a year, you know, and just to check in. Hey, you know, how's it going? And you know, I don't doubt that he talked to some other students probably more frequently than he did, you know, to me. But he would he took it upon himself just to say, hey, you know, how are you doing? You need anything? Any problems? And just strike up a conversation with you, just to make sure everything was getting along well and you were doing well. And I think that, in fact, I'm sure that he did that, not just because it was part of his job,
right,
but because he was genuinely concerned
yes.
about us as students, wanted us to be successful, and just really wanted to do anything that he possibly could to help ensure that we were
I mean, I wasn't on the receiving end of that, but I just know, knowing him, no doubt that was
genuine. And and likewise on Samuelson was the same genuine kind of caring person, you know, who wanted us to succeed at Gustavus and wanted us to get the best possible educations, you know, possible. And look, you know, there's kind of an irony that I remember now. I when I was there, there was a female student who came from some place that I had never heard of, that I'm very familiar with now, but at the time period I had never heard of. But she was from the South Carolina Sea Islands.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And she was from an overwhelmingly black environment, and for a variety of reasons, you know, was not successful at Gustavus, didn't fit in, and could not adjust to the overwhelmingly white presence, because I mean, it was such a direct contrast.
Yeah, anybody who knows anything about the Sea Islands, I mean, that's incredible. I mean, like, incredibly different.
And so you know, I'm kind of wondering, and some of us said, well, like, didn't you know where you coming? You know, it's interesting though, in another way also, but I ran our graduate program here at the College of Charleston for a number of years, and I had a black student that I recruited to the program, who really was from a totally black educational experience, from elementary school all the way through undergraduate degree, and our program overwhelmingly white, and she just could not, this student just could not adjust. I talked with her, counseled her and everything, and did my best to try to, you know, help her to see that she could be successful.
Right.
But ended up dropping out. Yeah,
it doesn't always work.
Yeah, it doesn't always work.
We try our best. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could go on forever about your time at Gustavus. It's also interesting, but I want to shift a bit now to your, not a bit, I want to shift to you, your career. I mean, first of all, Northwestern, this is a little bit of, sorry, listeners inside, this is shop talk, but who'd you work with at Northwestern for the PhD?
Yeah, I worked with George Fredrickson, who was my chief advisor, in Southern history, and also Sterling Stuckey.
Sure,
yeah.
I wondered. These are two of the greats. I went to Northern Illinois University for my for my BA and MA, where I worked with Al Young in early American history. He'd gone to Northwestern, and I remember McGovern. I always tell my students, one reason I voted for McGovern. He was a historian, PhD from Northwestern, great department. I mean, wow, you were there. I mean, great, great faculty that you worked with, Fredrickson and Stuckey and others. Were you already focused on Charleston at that point, or when did that develop?
I really learned about Charleston as a graduate student. And actually the person who put me on to Charleston was Sterling. And that's interesting because Sterling was not an urban historian per se.
Right.
He's a specialist in African American culture. The Charleston connection came about because I was interested in traditional African culture. And so actually when I started my graduate program at Northwestern, I started off on the African side. But for a variety of reasons, I ended up switching over to the US side. But I always had a tremendous interest in African history and African culture, and Sterling really helped me cultivate an interest in the international transmission of traditional African culture.
Yes.
And the way in which that influenced the lives of African people in the diaspora.
Right.
I was also interested in the 19th century, which I am still mainly focused on. And finally, I was interested in urban history and emancipation. Fredrickson kind of got me focused on emancipation and what it actually meant. So I put all of these things together. And this is shortly after John Blassen, the late John Blassen game, had published his book on New Orleans, Black New Orleans during Reconstruction.
Another great historian, great book.
And so I wrote to him and asked him. I wrote to him and Greg, I think I still have that letter somewhere. His letter, his response to me. And I says, hey, is anyone working on Charleston? And he says, no, I don't think anybody's working on Charleston. And so that's kind of how I got to Charleston, because, I knew about, from Sterling, I knew about the tremendous presence of African-derived culture in the Lowcountry.
Right.
And the way that was such a powerful force. So, hey, you could look at that in Charleston. You could also study emancipation in Charleston. You could do a little urban history by looking at Charleston. And so the rest, as they say, is kind of history. And so I continue to work on it.
There can't be anybody who knows more about you than both the history of slavery and emancipation in Charleston. Tell us a little bit about that for listeners who may not know. Why I first learned about the significance of Black life in South Carolina through Peter Woods. What was it called? Black
Majority. Oh, my goodness. Yes, Black
Majority. Long time ago, right? We were both a lot younger. But anyway, tell us a little bit about what's distinctive about the Black experience in Charleston. I mean, talking about the Black experience in terms of slavery and emancipation compared to other, even other states in the South.
Sure. Yeah.
Other cities and states.
Yeah. And Greg, I'm so glad you mentioned Peter Wood. And I was with Peter. I was with Peter back in September. Charleston, the College of Charleston hosted the national conference for the slave dwelling project down here. And Peter was one of the special panelists at one of the panels at the conference.
That's great.
I had a chance to really talk with him. I remember seeing his book downtown Chicago on Wabash Avenue at Crocs.
Oh my God! I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. That was my second home. My brother and I spent so much of our parents' money in that bookstore.
Yeah, that's right. That's
oh
right,
my
man.
Gosh.
Yeah, and so really, the mid-70s. I mean, I think it's probably 1974, right on the shore. I remember seeing it, and I still have the book. There's his book, and I see the spine. The title Black Majority. I say, what is this?
Yeah.
And I look at it, pull it down, look at it. And it's the history of Black people in South Carolina from 1670 to 1739. And this is the time period when we did not think you could do Black history in the colonial period. And I find this book, I see this book, and it's wholly based in the colonial period, not even using all of the 18th century.
Right.
And this is really astounding. And so I immediately bought it.
That's hardback, a great story.
Hardback copy for $9.95, Greg. $9.95. Yeah. And so, you know, I saw Peter recently and I had him sign it and everything.
That's nice.
You know, yeah. But one of the things that that's distinctive about the South Carolina experience, not singular, but certainly distinctive, is the Black majority, which develops early on here. And it develops as early as 1708. Most Black people, most of the inhabitants of South Carolina are Black. And that is the demographic profile for the colony and the subsequent state for it's for most of the history between its foundation about 1920. As 1920s, it'll become a primarily white state, and that has a lot to do with the Great Migration, Black people migrating away. Also, the Atlantic slave trade was especially important in this place, and as it turns out, Charleston was the major hub of the Atlantic slave trade for all of North America. And we know that somewhere between 45% and half of all of the Africans imported into North America came into what will become the United States through the port of Charleston.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really is. And when the Atlantic slave trade finally ends in 1808, it really ends for the nation in Charleston, because all of the other states had backed away from and ended their involvement in the foreign slave trade. So that federal law only affected South Carolina and Charleston in particular. The Civil War, of course, begins here.
Right.
You can look out from downtown across the harbor and see Fort Sumter, where the first shots of the Civil War are fired. Reconstruction was a very important period here in South Carolina because of that prominent Black presence in the population that translated into political power. And that meant that during Reconstruction, South Carolina was the only Southern state that had a Black majority in the lower house of the state legislature. And one of the things that happened as a result was that the state's public university, South Carolina College, today we know as the University of South Carolina, was forcibly integrated through the political power of black and white Republicans who opened the university up to black students for the first time during this period of Reconstruction. And so South Carolina is the only state that during Reconstruction had a racially integrated public university.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I mean, a number of the state legislators attended university there, attended law school in particular, took law degrees and so on and so forth. And so it's a place that has a deep, storied African American history, some important episodes in the civil rights movement occurred here in South Carolina, right here in Charleston. I mean, people know the Brown v. Board decision, but the point is that the very first legal case to challenge racial segregation head on as a violation of the Constitution was tried here in South Carolina, and the trial of Briggs versus Elliott in the late 1940s is tried in downtown Charleston.
In Charleston, yeah.
In federal court.
Now, most people don't know that. I mean,
Right. We associate Kansas and Brown, No, the first one is a South Carolina case. Yeah.
It's an amazing history, such a rich history.
Yeah.
The and I'm envious. I mean, in a way, because you're steeped in it, you know so much about it. The other thing I think is really wonderful about your work is your work, and you've touched on it a little bit in what you were just saying, but your work as a public historian. That is just so important in general, but the work you're doing. So for example, I don't know what came of this, but you were, I guess it was an op-ed you wrote about, calling for, not taking down monuments, but putting up monuments, right?
Yes.
To African Americans.
Yes.
I mean, the contribution of black soldiers to the Union effort in the Civil War and, including from South Carolina. Did anything ever come of that call to erect a monument? I can't remember what it was called. What was the place where you were trying to put it up in Winter or something, or what?
Well, there's a place in the downtown area, really right at the tip of Peninsula Charleston, that we call it the Battery, but it's also known as White Point Garden.
That's it. That's what I was thinking of, the garden. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a huge monument to the Confederacy right there at the tip of the peninsula in this wonderful bucolic garden area. And it was erected in the 1930s. So, again, most people who haven't studied these things think that they were erected immediately after the war. No. Decades and decades later, and the message was, hey, the values of the Confederacy continue to be predominant here, and white supremacy is the way to go. And these statues were designed to reinforce that notion. What has happened, ironically, Greg, is that since we wrote that editorial, I'm pretty sure the editorial was written first, in June of 2020, the John C. Calhoun Monument, which was located in Marion Square, it's the largest green space in Midtown Charleston, and the John C. Calhoun statue towered above that square, that green space, it was about 110 feet tall with Calhoun at the top of the pedestal. That finally did come down. That finally did come down after decades of people's expressed opposition to Calhoun being there, and Calhoun was in the South one of the leading architects for the pro-slavery argument,
right?
And one of the main architects of the theory of constitutional nullification and secession.
Right.
So even though he died before the Civil War happened, a lot of what he did during the course of his life laid the intellectual foundation.
That's right.
For secession and the coming of the Civil War.
We have no doubt which side he would have been on.
Yeah. That is absolutely right. But, you know, a number of us argued that, listen, let's focus on trying to expand what people see in the landscape by, yes, adding additional monuments which tell a story of brotherhood, a story that embraces all of humanity, a story that's not exclusive, a story that's not connected to racial oppression. Let's put up monuments that really accentuate the better angels of our nature.
Yes.
But, you know, the problem with Calhoun, 110 feet above the city, was that you couldn't put up anything comparable to that. You know, you couldn't just erect a little plaque which kind of detailed Calhoun's right. life. because the thing that people would always see would be that towering, scowling statue
right.
of Calhoun spewing white supremacy and black oppression. But over at the Center for the Study of Slavery in Charleston, which is based at the college, we've embarked in connection with some other groups on campus, we've embarked on a program to study the buildings on campus and to erect signage where we can to detail the Black history of several important buildings that are on campus that heretofore have been unrecognized.
That's really great.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of what that, I mean, some of this has been happening across the, well,
yeah, across
I mean,
the country.
Different, I mean, I know Clemson is looking into yes. sort of the Black history there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And so this is the kind of thing that we are attempting to do. Nothing has come down on our campus, despite the fact that there are buildings that are named after known segregationists and racists. But we have taken this approach thus far, which is designed to accentuate the positive. And we will tell the stories, the full stories, of those people who have their names on buildings, where some of the deeds that they have done that have been negative and that have been oppressive, those stories need to be told, and hopefully we will tell those stories also.
I think that's just great. I really yeah. do. And that's kind of, I mean, it's not the same thing but at all, not equivalent, yeah. but it's one reason I want more of the story about Gustavus and its Black students and the role of people like Bruce Gray and Owen Samuelson and
yeah.
others in recruiting Black students to the campus in the 60s and 70s. I want that story to be better known and not sure. just on the campus. I know there's some scholars who've written about it, but still it's, I mean, most of our students, even some of our Black students have no idea. So yes. I just think recovering these sort of aspects, little known aspects of the institutional history is really important. And it is. You know yes. more than I do about Craig Wilder's work and on the universities and slavery in the universities. And so I want to go to the center now. We're coming. What about, so you're directing that, you're still doing that, right? Even in quote unquote retirement.
Yeah. Yes.
What were you one of the founders of that, by the way? I meant to ask you that.
Yes. I'm really the founding director of the Center for the Study of Slavery in Charleston.
Which is incredible. I've looked at it online. What about the latest, this is also your work, you're busy. your latest work as a public historian, which is as the, president or interim president, I guess it is, of the International African American Museum. What's that about?
Yeah, well, what happened was the fellow who was serving as our president, who really had a business background, he was working with Mayor Riley, who was one of our leading supporters of the effort to build the museum. They really did yeoman's work to spearhead the capital campaign in which we raised the money for the building.
How much was raised?
It's around $100 million for the building.
Oh my gosh.
A bit over $100 million for the building itself.
That's incredible. So congratulations.
Thank you. And that provides no money for programming or anything like that.
Right.
But just a construction.
Just to make, build it.
Yeah. So then once that was achieved, Michael Moore, who was our president and really had a business background, wanted to go back to his business career. And so he did that. And so I'd been on the board for a long period of time. And I was convinced to step in as kind of interim CEO for the museum, basically because people were familiar with me because I had been with the project for a long time. And we did have someone in place who could handle the day-to-day management. And so that's what our COO Elijah Hayward was doing. And so I really, as interim CEO, was kind of the face of the museum.
It must be fun to be literally on the ground floor.
That's true. Now that ended about a year and a half ago when we did hire permanent CEO, Dr. Tanya Matthews, who came to us from Wayne State University, where she was in the provost office.
In Detroit,
In Detroit. But she had a history of leadership in science museums, most recently in Detroit. And so she's our CEO and president now. And I'm still a member of the board and have gone back to what I've worked on for many years, which is the program committee. And it's really been the program committee in conjunction with our museum consultants that really put together the intellectual plan for the several galleries and the kind of overarching themes for the museum.
What's the word? I'm curious about the word international there in the title or in the name, because it's not just African American Museum, it's international. Yeah. What is that about?
Yes. And thank you for asking about that, because, Greg, we try to, as much as possible, capitalize on our location here in South Carolina and in Charleston. The museum is based in Charleston, the east side of Charleston on the Cooper River. And what we argue is that African-American history, and especially South Carolina's African-American history, does not end with the borders of the United States.
Yes.
Since we're really located right on the Atlantic Ocean, a lot of that history has to be considered within the broader context of the Atlantic and the Caribbean.
Yes.
And so that's really what international means, and we try to flesh that out in a number of ways through the exhibits in the museum. So for example, in 1739, the Stonewall Rebellion occurs in South Carolina, in which somewhere between 70 and 100 black men rise up, and they begin to assault white plantation owners in their march southward, where they hope to reach Florida. And Florida, of course, is owned by Spain, so it's a separate country. And Spain, the Spanish authorities in Florida had for many decades prior to 1739 encouraged British slaves in Charleston, in
South Carolina, come on to
our
side.
to run away and to accept Catholicism and to live under Spanish rule, and if they did so, they would be granted their freedom. See, and so what happens is the Stonewall Rebellion was unsuccessful. The South Carolina militia quashes the insurrection in 1739, but guess what happens the next year? In 1740, the British forces from South Carolina and Georgia invade St. Augustine. Now, when you go down to St. Augustine, to Castillo San Marcos, the big fort down there, there's a timeline. And the timeline indicates that in 1740, the British invaded the fort. And that's all that it says. Well, why did they invade the fort? You can't tell from the timeline, but we who know South Carolina's history know that the Brits invade Spain in St. Augustine in retaliation for this encouragement that the Spaniards had for decades extended, and the invitation that they had extended to British slaves to come down and seek freedom in their midst. So this really is a situation where the assertion of black agency,
yes, yeah, exactly,
leads to what? International conflict, yeah, in the American Southeast.
Yeah, it's
between
a
Spanish colony and a British colony.
It's a great example.
Yeah, yeah.
And the book, the other thing, the 101 African Americans, I know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I read a blurb, you commented about that book, but again, the emphasis on not just kind of the usual people, but the agency of so many African Americans in Charleston who, or in South Carolina, not just Charleston, who, you know, I mean, sir, I wouldn't know, and maybe even a lot of many experts wouldn't know, but that emphasis on agency is super important. And yes, there is intersecting with international history, foreign relations. And,
yes.
That's great. It's fantastic.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I could go on forever. I have to stop. They're going to get mad at me. The people who edit, but yeah. I want to, the other, you know, you wrote this, I think you wrote, well, maybe you co-authored one book, but it's about Emmanuel, the church,
yes,
that was attacked by the white supremacists. Was that 2015?
The attack, the murders occurred June 17, 2015. And the book came out a year later in 2016. Okay.
Were you a member of that church, or are you a member of that church?
Not a member of that church, but a member of the AME denomination,
denomination. Yeah.
My church is about six blocks away, and historically, my church grew out of Mother Emmanuel AME Church. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I found a quote, at least this is a quote attributed to you, I think recently, it was on the Gustavus webpage. What matters most to me in the world is engendering a sense of care and compassion for life in general. And I don't know you well, but just getting to know you in person when you're on campus recently and now through this conversation, you're clearly a humane person, a caring person. I just wonder. I mean, I ask this of myself too. And how do we stay hopeful and optimistic in the face of the horror that was Emmanuel, in the face of the horror that was George Floyd, and on and on and on, in the face of just this resurgent white supremacy that is all around us right now.
Sure.
How do you, I mean, if you do, if you are hopeful, if you'll remain optimistic, I find my compassion capacity, strained.
Yeah, certainly gets challenged.
And
Yeah. Well, a number of things. And first and foremost, I'm a religious person. I'm a Bible believing Christian. So first and foremost. And so that really shapes my life.
Okay. That's a source of hope.
Yeah, that's right. That is exactly right. But the other thing, you know, on the secular side is this. I think that there are those aspects of my involvement in history that are encouraging also, because I've seen so many things in my life that I told people would never happen. I've seen those things happen. I can remember back in the 1980s telling someone, oh, there will never be a black Miss America. Mm-hmm. That'll never happen. I don't care what she looks like. Well, we've seen that happen, right? Oh, a black president of the United States? Are you kidding me? That can never happen. So I have to remind myself of things like that, that are examples of the general principle that I've always expressed to my students. And that is, when you do history, you have to be prepared to be surprised. Because when you think you know the story and you've got all the facts, there will be something that you will find that will throw them all into disarray and move the story in a different direction. And of course, you know, I think of, Greg, this is something that frequently I tell my students too. Now, Ida B. Wells, who you know familiar,
yes.
you know a lot about Ida B. Wells, born in slavery during the Civil War, great activist. In 1968, when I was taking the SAT exam, 1967-1968, Ida B. Wells' daughter was my tutor.
My God, that's amazing.
Was my tutor.
Wow.
1967.
She was a great black journalist. For listeners who don't know, she was fought for lynching, anti-lynching laws, knew Frederick Douglass. I mean, she's an amazing woman.
Yeah. That's
right. Incredible.
Yeah, that's right. So that's how close slavery is to me.
That's right.
Is to me.
Yeah.
And I think about how different my life is from that experience.
Yes.
Those things keep me hopeful despite the current events.
Yeah, and you I love that comment. You have to be prepared to be surprised. That's absolutely right about history. And I think what you're also saying, I try to convey to my students, I'm with you. I mean, there are times when I look at our past, U.S. historian like you, and it, you know, there's some nasty stuff to say,
yeah,
at least,
my goodness.
Which we've touched on here. Yeah. But then there are also hopeful moments and positive moments and progress. It's not linear, right? But I mean, so for example, let's celebrate. Let's not only talk about you. I know I'm preaching to the choir here. You know, let's not only talk about enslavement, let's talk about resistance to it mm-hmm. by Black people and, you know, and some white people as well.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think to think about history as a source of hope, sometimes it's leavened with some realism. I
mean, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that is powerful. So I love your answer that there's both that religious dimension to it and that secular dimension to it that comes from you being a historian and having historical perspective. So, gosh, I've enjoyed this. I'm sorry.
Well,
we have to do it again because there's more I want to ask you about, and I'm not kidding. And we will. Oh. I really, there's so much more. Congratulations on the upcoming opening of the museum. And thank you so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed meeting you and your wife, Lorraine, and who works, by the way, though. Is she still working at Governor's? Or she was at Governor's, whatever it was called.
She was a student at Governor's State.
That's what it is, which was not far from where I lived in Park Forest.
That's right.
Always a small world.
Master's degree. There.
That's what it was. Yeah. Always a small world. So thank you so much for making the time. I'm so glad we were able to do this. Take care. We'll see you in Charleston.
Okay. Thank you very much, Greg, for the opportunity. Look forward to seeing you again soon.
Likewise. Real pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.